Chapter 3. Pain. In third grade, I started getting a stabbing pain behind my eye that would wake me from my sleep in the middle of the night, screaming and sweating. I had no idea what was happening to me. It was absolutely terrifying. It's hard for me to talk about the pain of a cluster headache. My urge is always to minimize. The pain feels like a searing hot poker stick is being shoved into my skull through my eye socket. It really felt like I was dying when I would wake up at 2 a.m., screaming and crying, and start to bang my head against the wall. Sometimes the pain was so intense that I would vomit or piss the bed. The first few times it happened, my parents thought I had woken up from a nightmare. They had me climb into their bed and held me, rubbed my back until I was able to fall back asleep. Soon, though, they began to happen every night. I became terrified of going to bed, and my mother's sympathy began to run thin. They took me to the doctor, who said I had a sinus infection, and put me on a round of antibiotics. The antibiotics had no effect on my pain, so they took me back to the doctor. She told my parents they were stress headaches, psychosomatic, and that I just needed to calm down, and they would go away. In other words, I was faking it. It felt like I had been stabbed, like I was bleeding, like I was dying and needed immediate attention and relief, and everyone around me was rolling their eyes in disbelief. If you have cluster headaches, it changes you. I've met a few other people who have them. When you realize the shared experience, there are certain things you know they will understand. If you joke casually about the many times you've been suicidal, there will be no misunderstanding about exactly what you mean. When you experience intense, repeated trauma before the age of 11, while your brain is still going through critical development phases, something happens to you. Eventually, I stopped running to my parents. I had to take care of myself, try to soothe my own pain. I would lie in bed, trying to sob as quietly as possible so that I wouldn't wake anyone. On particularly bad nights, I would go to the bathroom, lay my head on the cool tile, and bite a washcloth or my stuffed rabbit, Bunny, so that I wouldn't scream. If I vomited or pissed in my bed, I learned how to use the washer and dryer and would clean my own sheets so nobody would know. I went from being a healthy child to getting sick all the time. On Valentine's Day, I woke up feeling particularly wretched. I begged my mother not to send me to school. "It will be easy," she said. "Your class is just having a party. You won't have to do any work." I was fucked up. The classroom was decorated in red crepe paper and delicate white doilies. The party had cupcakes and chocolate and all kinds of special treats, but the only thing I could eat without vomiting was Jell-O. I lay on the ground. One of the mothers who was volunteering at the party felt my forehead, saying I looked flushed, and then sent me to the nurse. I had a fever of 102 degrees, so they sent me home. I lay in bed and sipped Gatorade, my mother sighing as she tucked me into bed. When I was sick, it was usually a stomach bug. I became an expert at making it to the toilet, or at least a trash can, before I hurled. A few times I didn't make it and vomited all over the school hallway. The most embarrassing incident was during my gym class. We were running outside. It was early morning and still cool out, the type of chilly spring morning that would soon give way to heat. I felt nauseous, but I tried to push through, trying to run as fast as I could until I couldn't. I got halfway across the blacktop before I spewed, right in the middle of everyone else, running in laps around me. My gym teacher rubbed my back and gave me some water and they sent me home. Another morning, still at home, I hadn't slept all night. The headache wouldn't seem to stop. I begged my mother to let me stay home. At home, when everyone else was gone, it was quiet and peaceful under the covers in my bed, and the splitting pain of the headache was easier to manage than it was at school, in a classroom full of unruly kids and fluorescent lights. I cried and cried, and I threw up all over myself and the floor. I hadn't made it to the bathroom. My mother, losing her patience, snapped at me to clean it up. "I'm sick," I told her. "I don't feel good. Something is wrong." "The only reason you threw up was because you were crying so much. Clean it up, and get ready for school. Don't let it stain the floor. A boy who lived in my building seemed to be my mortal enemy at the time. Our parents would leave us alone together after school, and I hated it. He would pull my hair, call me names, grab at my body. I would get in trouble for hitting him when he was bothering me. I felt he deserved it. He wouldn't listen when I told him to stop. He would burst into my room while I was getting dressed and stare at me. He would pull off my clothes. I would ask him to stop, then yell, then hit him to get him off me. When I yelled or hit him, my mother would punish me with a spanking. I felt like a cornered wild animal. He would scream into my ears while I was having a headache, and I would scratch him, and he would bleed, and he would laugh at me and say I would be spanked again. Sometimes his mother would punish him, too, but it did nothing to stop him. My mother would tell me to ignore him, say that if I ignored him, he would stop. Once I ignored him for nearly 8 hours straight, I ended up locked in my room, him banging on the door, singing and taunting me. Nothing seemed to make him stop. When I was older, in family therapy, I reminded my mother of this and how upsetting it was to be punished for trying to defend myself, for trying to have boundaries. My mother tried to tell me I should have just ignored him again, should have been the bigger person. The therapist jumped in. Sometimes a kid needs to get smacked on the playground. Sometimes that's the appropriate response, so they know not to cross that boundary again. Should I have just lain back and let him touch me however he liked without hitting him? What would that have taught him? What would he have done with other women he met later in life? I don't think people can just lie back and let others bulldoze their boundaries. We all have the right to self-defense. This was a lesson I had to learn with my father as well. In many ways, I felt like the sacrificial lamb of the community. My father could not hear no, stop, just like this boy could not hear it. He loved tickling me. I hated it. There was one time I kept yelling at him to stop. It was so painful and overwhelming, but he wouldn't, so I kicked him hard in the face. He was infuriated. He yelled at me until I was cowering in the fetal position under my covers and crying. I would think about what happened and struggle with whether or not I had done wrong. It was so hard for me to know whether I was crazy, whether it was okay for me to say no, to ask someone to stop them myself if they were doing something that hurt me. My father didn't fully understand what was happening with the cluster headaches, but he did know I was in pain. Some nights, he would climb into bed with me and hold me until I would fall asleep. He would weave elaborate fairy tales involving dragons and princes and princesses who dressed up as peasants, who overthrew evil, who slayed dragons, who prayed to God. Sometimes I would wake up with my father still holding me. Once I heard my mother yelling at him, saying I was too old for him to cuddle with, that he shouldn't lie in bed with me like that. He didn't do it again. The affection for my father, while inappropriate at times, was still the only affection I had received, and I longed for it. My mother never comforted me. She never told me she loved me. My grandfather died of a heart attack after a hurricane had damaged their home in Florida. My grandmother was immensely sad, or so my mother told me. She sold the apartment in the city and moved to Florida full-time. Her best friend lived just down the road from her. Her husband had died too. They would cook together and walk along the beach looking for shells. I missed her desperately. I was always an avid reader, but now reading became something more, a way to cope with the pain. When the pain of the headaches was at its worst, my eyes would lose focus, cross, and I wouldn't be able to read the words anymore, seeing double, but that part usually wouldn't last for more than half an hour. My headaches were seasonal, and during the peak of headache season, the pain would start around 9 p.m., quickly become overwhelming around 9:30 p.m. After that, it would taper off, and I would have a bit of a respite. I would read an escapist fantasy novel, the type with a bookish female protagonist, misunderstood by the adults and peers in her life, who finds a way to escape into an alternative universe, one where she has special powers. Those books saved me. I would read until 2 a.m., when the pain of the headache would peak again. Then, as it died down, I would read again until I was calm enough to fall asleep, often around 4 a.m. I would get 2 hours of sleep before I would have to get up to get ready for school at 6 a.m. The first year, I had headaches. I tried to bargain with God. I was familiar with the story of Job. I thought I needed to be patient, but I began to question my faith, which was said to be natural around the age I was at the time, 11 or so. About 2 years into the headaches, in a moment of weakness, I asked the demon to possess me if she would take my pain away. Yet there was no answer from the dark either. The pain persisted. I begged my parents for a dog, and they finally relented. The first night, she slept in my room in her crate. She was whining and whining to be let out. It seemed to me that she understood my pain. I let her out, and she jumped into my bed, and I held her as I fell asleep. Even though I was so young, I think if I hadn't had that dog, I would have killed myself. The week before we got her, I found instructions online for using a razor blade to slit your wrists in the tub. But she would lick all the tears off my face, come and lie in my lap whenever I was in pain, even if I didn't allow signs of it to show externally. There was at least one living being who understood my pain was real, even if she wasn't human. As I read and learned more about other religions, I read stories that were eerily reminiscent of the story of Jesus, and it seemed to me that the Bible itself was entirely unoriginal. These doubts scared me. My entire life philosophy was created around these binaries of truth and lies and good and evil. If I began to question my Christian faith, which was foundational, I had to question everything. My parents, the church, the political figures my father listened to on the radio. I began to develop two binary theories of the world, one where the Bible was absolutely true and one where it wasn't. I knew that if I stopped believing in God as my church taught him, I would no longer be able to believe the things Rush Limbaugh said on the radio with such confidence. If there is no God, there is no one who justifies all the deeply unethical things carried out in his name. I loved this James Madison quote. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. There was a dinner when I was 9 at the home of an older member of my church. Their apartment was decorated very tastefully, and I remember staring at the molding, trying to memorize the design. I was wearing a shimmering green dress in a style that was popular at the time, slim with spaghetti straps, my hair in a low ponytail, and I had painted my nails a sparkly navy blue, a color given to me by my estranged grandmother. The father of the pastor examined my nails. "That's a very sexy color," he told me. "Why are you trying to be so sexy?" My mother, standing behind me, said nothing, but I felt her tense, as she often would, as though I was standing before a hungry tiger and she might need to snatch me out of its teeth. I said nothing. It was around that time that I noticed the women in the church had begun to give me strange looks. I had started to go through puberty early and I was very pretty. The women looked at me like I was a dangerous, unruly beast. The men looked at me differently. There was a book fair at my school, and my mother had given me $30 to spend on books. I spent so long browsing, picking up different books, trying to decide the best way to spend my money. When I went up to the counter to pay, a mother who was volunteering at the fair grabbed my hand hard, holding it longer than I felt comfortable with. "You're very pretty," she said. She had a look in her eyes and a tone of voice that I didn't understand. I sometimes try to think back and understand what her eyes were telling me. Was it anger? Jealousy? Was it a warning? Natalie's best friend moved away in second grade, and throughout third grade, she gradually became my best friend. She was a beautiful girl with soft brown hair and hazel eyes. We weren't in the same class together, much to my dismay, but our moms would set up frequent playdates, usually at least once a week. We would play together in the park, gathering wild raspberries, pretending to be cats, or go swimming in her pool. She had a bikini. She wasn't someone I connected with on an intellectual level, like Mei Mei. But I learned quickly there were other types of intelligence. She would play pop music for us to dance to. She would tell me how to move my hips to look sexy, spray me with some of her Juicy Couture perfume, put a bit of lip gloss on my lips. We would talk about whatever boy she had a crush on at the time. I thought she was so glamorous, interesting, talented. Natalie's mother was obsessed with her daughter being a famous actress one day, and Natalie would tell me all about her little Broadway roles or being a part of the children's ensemble at the Met Opera. Of course, I was a little in love with her. Her mom would call us in for snacks. One time, she had made a few slices of buttered toast. "Put honey on mine," Natalie said. Her mother spread hers with honey. "Open your mouth," Natalie said to me. "I want you to try some. It's so sweet." Natalie and I were both a part of the same Girl Scout troop. After Natalie and I became friends, I grew more comfortable with attending. I didn't really interact too much with the other girls besides Natalie. I wasn't quite sure how to. At the time, I thought they disliked us. Now, I realize they probably saw us as closed off and removed. We would have so much fun together, going camping or participating in whatever activities were required to earn badges. We were always the rowdy group. My troop leader was extremely fun and chill, and the other parents, more controlling, would look on with disdain as we made messes with glitter, shouted and laughed, continued whispering after lights out. I hated school. Before, I had loved it, but loved learning. But now I was in pain or sleep-deprived or sick much of the time, and I had a teacher who, to me, seemed ill-equipped to handle a class of children. He was desperate to be seen as cool, as chill, to have us like him. He'd play guitar for us, which I found insufferable. I missed the rigorous but fair teachers I had had in earlier classes, who would vacillate between having lax rules to suddenly screaming at everyone for being too loud. I craved calm order. I stopped turning in my homework because it felt stupid, repetitive, and uninspiring. And besides, I couldn't concentrate due to my headaches. He didn't know what to do with me. Star student trotted around as school genius, suddenly turned moody slacker. The community I grew up in was very, very wealthy. I had classmates whose families owned private jets and sprawling vacation homes. My family didn't have any of this, so growing up, I always thought we were poor. We were not. My parents were not the best at money management. I could hear them arguing about money and bills behind closed doors and always thought they were just one step from absolute ruin. They didn't seem to have any idea how to budget. They gave us a weekly allowance of $15. I asked if I could save it, then withdraw it later. Around Christmas, I asked for a year's worth of allowance so I could buy my siblings' birthday presents. I had been adding up the amount I should receive in my calendar. It was right around $700. My parents held a small meeting, then came back and told me they couldn't give me all of that all at once. That was my first lesson in counterparty risk. I think this is why I am able to deal so well with government interference in my line of work. I have no trust in authority figures or anyone else to honor their commitments. Friends are distressed to learn about civil asset forfeiture, where the American government can simply seize your assets and hold them indefinitely, even sell or spend them without making a conviction. This type of bullshit, in my eyes, is only to be expected. The next year, my fourth grade teacher was an idiot. I don't say that lightly. She infuriated me. It was her first year teaching out of college. Once, during class, we were examining a diagram of air pressure and heat. Hot air, which is less dense, is lighter and rises to the top. Cold air, being denser, falls. My teacher talked about how incredible this was. She said that as the air became closer to the sun, it was warmer. For example, the air on top of mountains is warm, while at sea level it was cold. I raised my hand. I believe the diagram shows that hot air rises, not that it is naturally hotter at the top. Do you really believe that air at the top of Mount Everest is warmer than at sea level by a beach? She looked at me flustered. Yes, it's just the wind blows and makes it feel cold. Later that month, she attempted to force us to have a debate about what the Earth would be like if the atmosphere was removed. She assigned us into teams, putting me on the team that would claim the Earth would become unbearably hot without the atmosphere to protect us. I rebelled. We already know what would happen. The moon has no atmosphere. It is around the same distance from the sun, and it is incredibly cold. I was frustrated that there was no higher authority for me to appeal to, that the other kids in class accepted this teacher's nonsense as fact. I complained to my mother, but she didn't care. Years later, my friend's younger brother was in her class. She was pregnant again, having had a baby every single year since she started teaching. "Why do you have so many babies?" he asked. "Why don't you stop having sex?" This was the year we had to pick an instrument to study. I had been receiving private piano lessons for years, but that wasn't an option, so I was deciding between studying the flute or the violin. If the harp had been an option, I told Natalie, I would have picked that. She chose percussion. "I love the xylophone," she said, stretching her illicit gum with her tongue and blowing a bubble, just out of sight of the teachers. Gum was extremely against the rules at our school. It was banned, they told us, because the janitors were constantly having to scrape gum off of every surface imaginable. The floor, the ceiling, lockers, desks, toilet stalls. Of course, this just made chewing gum even more alluring. The boy, who was the main gum dealer in school, had his locker right next to mine. Every time we had break, crowds of kids would stand around, keeping an eye out for teachers, shoving crumpled $5 bills into his hands. He would buy the gum on his way to school every day and spend his profits on Pokemon cards. He would always offer me some for free, with a wink, maybe because he thought I was a narc. Ballroom dancing was a required class that year. I loathed it. I was passable at dancing, but I was awful at letting the boys lead. I always put my hands in the wrong place. I never learned how to let them guide me. Tragically, I was not paired up with Dylan. We were in some gifted class together, and I totally had a crush on him. I was forced to dance with some lacrosse player I would now call a douche, though I'm not sure I was familiar with that term at the time. My skin crawled as he held my hands. One day, before we started dancing, I caught him picking his nose. So gross. I was such a judgmental and pretentious asshole as a kid, but I think most people just assumed I was shy and nervous. People would try to get me to open up, and I would just be desperate to go back to reading Lord of the Rings. In fourth grade, the night the latest Harry Potter book was released, I stayed up late reading it, and I finished it. In the hallway before class, I teased Dylan, telling him I had finished it and that I knew the ending. He got mad at me and slammed his locker. "One day, you're going to mess up and you're going to fall asleep in class. Then you'll think twice about staying up so late reading." I never fell asleep. On some nights, when I was particularly distressed, I would sneak out. My parents were so dead asleep that they would never hear the door. And the doorman, who had a soft spot for me, never ratted me out. Everyone thought I was a goody-two-shoes, and no one expected a fourth grader to sneak out anyways. Sometimes I would walk for hours. Walking seemed to make the pain of my headaches lessen. My dog would be my companion. Thankfully, no one ever bothered me. I knew that anyone I told about the headaches wouldn't believe me, so I kept it to myself. Looking back at the photos of myself during that time makes my heart ache. I can see the dark circles under my eyes, the pained smile. I became very familiar with the waiting room at my doctor's office. The wood-paneled walls, the kind older secretaries who would dote on me, giving me lollipops and murmuring with my mother just out of earshot, the rows and rows of patient files. At first, the doctor just stuck to prescribing antibiotics, but eventually told my mother to give me different remedies. B-spectrum would help with my lack of energy, vitamin D for my depression, melatonin for my sleep, aspirin for my headaches. None of it seemed to help. My younger brother eventually developed migraines. He would lie in his bed, sometimes vomit from the pain, scream if the light got too bright. He went to see the doctor, and she immediately referred him to a neurologist who prescribed him Topamax. His migraines subsided. I asked my mother if she could take me to the neurologist. She told me to call the doctor myself. I told her I didn't know how to make an appointment, how to talk to a doctor. She was irritated. I never saw a neurologist. Of course, cluster headaches are much less common than migraines, and at the time, research on cluster headaches was scant, especially for people who had a childhood onset of the disorder. But I never even got to see a neurologist. My pain was immediately written off as false. A few years ago, I confronted my mother about this. I asked her why she allowed this to happen to me. I was just listening to the doctors. I thought I was doing what was best for you, she told me. I looked her in the eyes. I needed an advocate. I needed an adult who believed me. If the doctor didn't, you should have taken me to a doctor who did believe me. You are my mother. You are supposed to protect me. She asked if I could forgive her, and at the time, I said I couldn't. As we've grown closer, and she's been there for me in other ways, I finally trust her enough to let it go, to offer my forgiveness. My mother at the time was dealing with her own issues. She didn't speak of them, but I later learned she was very sick. She would lie in bed all day. My father told me she was lazy, that she was a bad wife and partner. He said that her mother, my grandmother, had apologized to him, saying that she had failed in raising someone to be a good wife or mother. Having no full understanding of what was going on, I was inclined to agree.